51 episodes. Okay, I'm not going to do that every time, but as we welcome you back to the ongoing journey through Stock Aitken and Waterman, it is a little bit like deja vu this time, isn't it, Matthew Denby?
Correct, Gavin Scott, because this episode we've got the same lineup of acts as we featured in episode 49. Kylie, Big Fun, and Donna Summer.
But things were quite different with each of those artists' latest singles. And while some of the differences we're going to talk about were good things, in a couple of cases it wasn't such great news. First up, we have a single that had a bit of both. It was great on so many levels, but it came with a hint of disappointment as well.
Yeah, here we go. We've got the third single from Kylie Minogue's second album, Never Too Late, which hit the charts in November 1989. Let's have a listen. Right, that was the brilliant Never Too Late by Kylie Minogue, which caused a few hearts to miss a beat by entering the UK charts at the relatively low, for Kylie, position of 17, before climbing to a peak of 4. While still a big hit, that position broke Kylie's run of 7 consecutive top 2 hits. Elsewhere, the song hit number 1 in Ireland, 11 in Spain, and 14 in Australia. So, were things starting to cool slightly for Kylie, or was something else going on? It's been reported this release was hit by stock supply problems, with not all formats being widely available across the UK until several days after its official release date, and that would certainly account for its slower than usual start.
Now, on that point, I sent David Howells a message to see if he remembered this incident of stock supply issues, and he had this to say, quote, "It's funny you bring that up, because a common industry complaint from other labels at the time was that PWL dominated demand at pressing plants across the UK and sometimes Europe, preventing them from getting their records to the market. Indeed, at one point we even bought our own pressing plant just to be able to fulfill demand, and even then it was a constant dilemma. When you make a record, you may think it's a potential smash, but you really have no idea how many you will sell. It's all guesswork until the audience decides. Then it's a scramble just to keep up with demand. Every day there are examples of artists who have a row of hit after hit, and then one misses or is slower to connect, and everyone is puzzled as to what went wrong. Back in the day, when it was all about manufactured product, it was the impossible equation." And then he went on to answer my question of whether he remembered this happening with Never Too Late, and he said he didn't.
Right. Interesting. Well, there was definite buzz in the UK media at the time of release that Never Too Late was a hot possibility for number one, and it was even introduced as such when Kylie performed on Top of the Pops.
Potential supply issues aside, it's worth keeping in mind that Never Too Late was the third single from an album that had just been released 2 weeks earlier in the UK. That order of doing things always puzzled me, and it's not something that's exclusive to this release or this record company. I'd have thought it would make sense to release the next single and then a week later put the album out. So perhaps some fans just thought, well, I have Never Too Late on the album. I don't need to buy the single as well.
Yeah, it was an unusual release schedule. Unless you're a dedicated collector who must have absolutely everything, it takes a lot of motivation to buy the same track after you've just bought it on an album weeks before.
In Australia, as you mentioned, Never Too Late missed the top 10 the first time that had happened for Kylie since I Still Love You, Je Ne Sais Pas Pourquoi, when that reached number 11, and only the second top 10 miss in her career. But it did spend longer in the top 50 than Wouldn't Change a Thing had done, racking up 12 weeks. And that chart life was no doubt extended due to the February 1990 dates on Kylie's Enjoy Yourself tour. On the local release, we got a mix of Made in Heaven as the B-side, but in the UK, the flip side to Never Too Late was Kylie's Smiley mix, which was put together by Tony King. The tracks all came from Kylie's first album and were, in order, I'll Still Be Loving You, It's No Secret, Je Ne Sais Pas Pourquoi, Turn It Into Love, I Should Be So Lucky and Gotta Be Certain, but the first two were dropped off for the 7-inch version of that. Let's take a quick listen to one of those mixes.
Yeah, this mix was certainly timely. We were headed into a new golden age of the mega mix, and not just because of Jive Bunny. Contemporary dance acts like Technotronic would soon be scoring chart hits by repackaging all their big songs this way too. The Smiley mix was a fun B-side, but that's where it belonged.
And Tony is the first to admit it was a fairly basic job. He's commented about it online, saying, quote, "I remember doing it very well and being told exactly what tracks I could use. I was never happy with it because it was done in a rush and just using straight tape edits." And so, in 2019, 30 years after Kylie's Smiley mix was on the B-side to Never Too Late in the UK, Tony recreated the mega mix using only equipment available in 1989, but with proper mixes between the tracks, and you can find that online.
Okay, that's the physical single discussed, but what about the song itself? One thing I feel for sure is that the song quality wasn't an issue with this release. This is a great Kylie record, and it's easy to see why so many people expected it to be number one at the time. It's very well structured, classic pop that's only grown enormously in esteem over the years. A lot of people regard this as one of the very best songs from Kylie's early career. Apparently, it was Michael Hutchence's favourite Kylie song, and if that doesn't impress you, it's also been quoted on Doctor Who. The track's got a lot to recommend it, a great uplifting chorus, and of course that fantastic middle eight. Let's have a listen to that moment. Oh, I tried.
Saul really were dishing out the middle eights that weren't just instrumentals or vocal effects in 1989, weren't they? I'm a big fan of that middle eight, especially the "you just creep right back inside" bit, which showed Kylie's Aussie twang was still present and accounted for. I really like Never Too Late as well, but it does feel a little bit like treading water. After Hand on Your Heart and Wouldn't Change a Thing, it wasn't really doing anything new, middle eight aside. I wasn't complaining at the time, and I still really rate it, but if I'm looking for a reason why it didn't chart as high as previous records, that may be it. It's also another example of Kylie singing songs about being unlucky, lucky, lucky, in love, or with guys who are no good, and that's something we'd see again in Better the Devil You Know. In the case of Never Too Late, she's trying to convince her boyfriend to change his mind, even though she's found out all about him. They like to depict her with these no good types, didn't they? Let's hear from Mike Stock about those lyrics, which to my mind are another case of kind of sad lyrics being matched to a perky poppy tune, and he has a different spin on things. Never Too Late's another one of those songs that is deceptively cheery. It's actually quite a sad song. That features in quite a few of your songs. I Don't Believe in Miracles, you know, the tears on the dance floor thing. Can you talk a little bit about that dichotomy of sounding bright and cheery, you know, but actually being quite sad?
Yeah, I suppose Kylie's I Should Be So Lucky is it's wistfully sad. You know, I wish I had love and romance in my life. Never Too Late, the way I was going with that in my head, because I say things like, why don't you try and be a man about it? And probably can't say that nowadays, can you, man up? But I was deliberately thinking it was old-fashioned. I was deliberately thinking that's what I wanted on this, kind of like, because later on, much later on, she did this version of it in Abbey Road, where they played it like one of those old-style things. I was thinking it more of like a 1920s song, where you could say, you know, I woke up this morning, the birds were singing, and it was all right to say that then. I suppose it's not desperately sad, that song. It's actually hopeful, isn't it? It's never too late, you know.
That's true. I mean, I guess, yeah, no, you're right. It is hopeful, even though she is complaining about him, you know, walking out and all that kind of stuff.
She's actually telling him off. He's behaving like a little boy again, you know, a spoilt brat. Now, why don't you just grow up? You can't keep doing this every time we have an argument about something. You walk out.
But it sounds so buoyant. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's about arguments and telling you off. And that's, right. I guess, the dichotomy I'm getting at is that it works on two levels. You can enjoy it and be catchy and all that, but then when you dive into it a bit deeper, you're like, oh, okay, this is actually...
Well, you know, but that's right. The layering up is something Matt and me like to do on musically, you know, in terms of sonically, musically, as well as lyrically and in terms of the songs. And there are still layers people haven't cottoned on to. Maybe in the next generation, people start more analytically examining it. But there's all sorts of stuff like that. Because Matt and me both did the cryptic telegraph crossword. and stuff like that. And when we formed Love This, we used all sorts of anagrams of mixing engineers of names we'd invented, you know. So we were always doing stuff like that. Not just to relieve the boredom, but to make some of the pressure slightly more fun, you know.
Right, interesting. And the sadness of the song was really emphasized by the Abbey Road version. Let's have a listen to that.
Why can't you try and be a man about it? And if you stop and think about it, you just can't keep walking out on me.
That reinterpretation was the highlight of that orchestral album for me, but I always go back to the original version. And part of why I liked the song so much at the time was the music video. The TV Week Logie award-winning music video, no less. Featuring five looks from five different decades, it was shot against a blue screen with those era-specific backdrops added later. Those looks were mostly inspired by movies, while the video had a proscenium arch of the type you'd see in theatres added around the border.
Yeah, it was a really memorable video for me, with the use of special effects and the fun dance sequences, as well as all those costume changes. That cowboy look really suited her, and I think she noticed that because not only did it end up on the single cover, but it came back a few more times over the years as Kylie's career progressed. Two words, cowboy style.
Let's hear a bit of an electronic press kit released at the time in which Kylie and Never Too Late's video director Pete Cornish talk about the clip. It's a little noisy, but worth a listen.
Pete and I were trying to decide on ideas for the film clip, and neither of us had any. And through the course of a phone call, we came up with this sort of toy theatre cross Hollywood idea, and just decided to have dress-up outfits. And I was actually tossing up between 70s and modern, but we went for 70s.
And we won.
It's basically all a dance video, but the idea is that we have five periods in the 20th century. It's 1920s. 1930s, 40s, 50s and 1970s. It's kind of 20s vamp with a silent movie look. 1930s, which is a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers routine. Then we have a Gene Kelly situation with some sailors and Kylie. The 50s is a Western.
Well, I feel mighty fine at the moment. Mighty fine.
Okay, I have to say my favourite look was the Ginger Rogers-inspired red dress, but the styling on the video was great across the board and a step up from previous videos. Even if it was a bit odd for a hippie to be hitting the disco with some John Travolta types, but I'll let that slide. Kylie would make up for that with her 70s looks in Step Back in Time after all. Now on the topic of looks, it's time to welcome stylist Sharon McPhillamy back to the podcast to talk about this video.
Never Too Late, which was a kind of dress up. So the looks were taken from the video treatment. So the video treatment existed first and then the looks came. So there were so many of those looks. I didn't do all of that by myself. So I got a stylist in because we had the 20s thing and we had, so the only one that was mine was the cowboy. So I did that. And all the others were kind of, because it was stylized rather than clothes. It wasn't clothes, it was looks for each scene. So that was kind of done that way.
I mean, the cowboy look ended up being the single cover, so that must have been nice.
That was one of my very favourite looks. I did love that, with the leopard skin chaps.
And was Kylie into that look?
She's a real chameleon, and she'll just, it must be because she's an actress. She puts something on and she becomes it. And so she's brilliant at that. And you see all the way through all those amazing millions of looks, I imagine, you know, she puts a cowboy hat on, she becomes a cowboy, you know, and she puts a cocktail dress on and, or she puts her flamenco feathers on and she becomes a showgirl. She is just that kind of person.
Great fun video.
It was fun. It was real fun. Yeah.
Were you on the set?
Yeah, I was always on the set. Mm.
And how was that? Because that would have been a long shoot, I imagine, with all those
They were always long. We always started at 6 o'clock in the morning and, you know, by midnight you'd be going, really? And then, no, just one more. Often we'd be there till 2, 3, 4 in the morning. Yeah, they were really long days. And, you know, poor old artist having to be, you know, made up. And, you know, you can imagine your makeup after 20 hours. Yeah, it's not nice. But anyway, they all did it with humility mostly.
Good stuff. So a third top five hit helped to push along sales of Kylie's second album, Enjoy Yourself. Backed by a major advertising blitz, the LP debuted at number one in the UK with pre-sales of over 600,000 copies and was certified four times platinum by January of 1990. It reached number nine in Australia and quickly went platinum here as well. Elsewhere, it hit number one in Ireland, six in New Zealand, and seven in Japan. That's definitely a good outcome for Kylie, who is now starting to stretch her wings a bit in anticipation of the major changes we'd see the following year. We saw some public evidence of that transformation with her appearance on Top of the Pops to promote Never Too Late. Wearing a skimpy pink bra top and orange trousers, the first signs of quote-unquote sex Kylie were here, several months ahead of Better the Devil You Know. And according to the late Gary Ashley of Mushroom Records, the changes in Kylie around this time weren't just superficial. He was quoted by Australian journalist Dino Scatina as saying this: "By this stage, Kylie didn't want to be messed over by anybody anymore. She wanted to control the image she was projecting, and she wanted to approve her artwork, and she wanted to hear what song she was going to record, and she wanted to hear the mixes. It was a very natural progression for any artist to make."
Yes, speaking of artistic progression, as we've heard previously, Matt Aitken, for one, was always happy not to put out 10 versions of the same idea, and he preferred to mix things up on albums. And that was certainly the case on Enjoy Yourself, with tracks like My Secret Heart, Telltale Signs, and Heaven and Earth, all of which we'll discuss in further detail in the bonus material.
Kylie had definite ideas for where she wanted to go with Enjoy Yourself. She said this to Rolling Stone Australia at the time: "With Enjoy Yourself, I said to them, I want to be able to sing on it. And yeah, I am clouded by computers a lot of the time, but that's pop music. And I don't want to just drop pop music. I like it. Enjoy Yourself is a step in the right direction. And with the next one, I want to be able to take a leap because I've got new confidence in myself and I think I'll have something more to offer."
Oh yes, we're both looking forward to getting to that leap. But as for now, there was also the title track on this album, Enjoy Yourself, which apparently Kylie wanted to release as the third single instead of Never Too Late. Enjoy Yourself, or Enjoy It, as she sometimes called it, since the lyrics never actually say the words Enjoy Yourself, leaned even more into dance music. So it seems Kylie got her wish for a more diverse second album, with Saw happy to accommodate that growing artistic involvement, to an extent.
Yes, apparently Kylie's new assertiveness created some issues in the studio. Matt Aitken was quoted by Dino Scatina as saying this about their evolving relationship: "There was one occasion where we'd half written something and Kylie was hanging around. There was a bit of pressure in the time department and I kindly asked Kylie if she wouldn't mind leaving us alone. I think she took offense at that." Added Mike Stock, "I can remember that instance. Kylie got very upset by that. You have to develop a relationship with your co-writers, and basically we were under pressure to finish this song. So Matt said, go on, Kylie, fuck off. It sounded harder than it was meant." Ouch.
Yeah, that's a very interesting definition of kindly asking her.
Exploring this turn of events further in his book, The Hit Factory, Mike wrote this: "There were certainly no punches pulled between me, Matt, or Pete. But when you're dealing with delicate young girls, you've got to be kind. Matt wasn't good at that. He reduced Kylie to tears on a number of occasions just by saying something thoughtless, such as, would you like to leave the room now, Kylie? I've got to discuss bass lines with Mike. Go off and make a cup of tea. Things like that sounded sarcastic and she was upset. She wanted to be a part of the creative team. But when you are concentrating on recording technicalities, you don't want anyone else in the room."
In the interview disc for her Ultimate Kylie compilation, Kylie spoke about recording at PWL at this stage. Let's take a listen.
"The first thing I think of is arriving at PWL, going through reception where they just had gold and platinum albums on all the walls, going upstairs, and a lot of the time I was there on my own and would just sit down in front of the TV and flip through the channels and literally wait till they were ready. And in retrospect, I think they did, when I say they, I mean Mike Stock, Matt Aitken, and Pete, if he was there. I guess they did the best that they could with me, but there was definitely times where I felt a little bit alone. I wasn't sure what I was doing, or to fly someone to be there. My manager couldn't be with me all the time. So yeah, I'd make a cup of tea and wait. That's just how it was in those days, and I fitted into that very well, I didn't, you know, I didn't complain. I didn't have dramas. I just thought, this is work. This is professional. It's not always comfortable. So let's get on with it.
Okay, now no discussion of Enjoy Yourself would be complete without a look at the album cover. As was the PWL way, Kylie had another hat on, a glittery golden number. Let's go back to Shazza now to talk about that memorable look on the cover of Enjoy Yourself. The Enjoy Yourself album.
Yeah, of course you're going to mention that, aren't you?
Yeah, what can you tell me about that gold hat and skirt?
The gold hat and skirt were just kind of part of a whole load of stuff that we had. And that was a massive shoot by Simon Fowler, who is so brilliant. And that one just made the album cover. Because the thing is, like I said before with Kylie, when she put something on, so she put the hat on and the skirt, I actually think that skirt might have been hers. She put the hat on and then, of course, she was going, oh, and she thought it was fun and funny, and she's great in front of the camera anyway. You know, she'll never duplicate a pose, and there were loads of them. So she was kind of jumping and happy and fun. And that's what came over, and that's what made the album.
It was very much in the fun, accessible, bright that we were talking about.
Yeah, and it was of its time, but, you know.
Do you think it hasn't aged as well, or?
It's possibly aged better than, you know, the first one with the hair through the hat. But again, I mean, that was of its time. And do you know what? They've kind of all become, in certain circles, they've all become iconic images. So, you know, whatever you say about them, that's what they are. And it was a moment in time and they worked.
And it's worth noting that the album got a whole new cover in the US. I think one of the few times Geffen got it right with a Saw record. I much prefer theirs. I was never sold on that gold hat. Sorry. Which cover did you prefer, Gavin?
Oh, David Howells must have hated that American album cover. If the UK covers were like Smash Hits magazine covers, then that US sleeve for Enjoy Yourself was like the front of some arty coffee table mag. No eye contact with the audience, a black and white photo, and washed out colours. I don't hate it. Narrator, he hates it.
Well, back in the UK, the back of the album also caused a bit of a stir, with some pressings apparently having inconsistencies in the song titles, causing some fans to write into the teen mags demanding an explanation. Well, Mike wrote this in his book. Oddly enough, the biggest hassles were caused not by the record companies, but by the printers, who had to prepare sleeves and labels for the end product. On one occasion, they printed the sleeve to a new Kylie Minogue album before we had actually written the songs. The guys at the plant just invented a couple of titles and I had to write the songs to match. There were also times when they printed the sleeve and got the title wrong.
Now, speaking of getting things wrong, that's the case with some information that came to light during our second interview with Mike Stock. Regular listeners will know that Matt Aitken told us that Gotta Be Certain had been written for Kylie and not Mandy Smith, as we'd always assumed. But it seems he was mistaken and did email me to let me know. But here's Mike to clear up the matter once and for all.
I've spoken to Matt about this. Gotta Be Certain was not written for Kylie.
He's corrected. Well, he's corrected himself to me.
Oh, has he now? Okay.
Because that's what I said. I was like, I questioned him, but I was like, well, you're Matt Aitken, so.
Yeah, no, well, see, Matt wouldn't necessarily have known. I'm sure he must have known I was taking it to Australia with me. I had to wrap up the multi-tracks in tin foil and put them in protective stuff to stop the x-rays damaging them.
Okay, glad that's sorted. So it was another hit, albeit slightly smaller than usual, for Kylie. Also enjoying another hit were our next Saw act, who are on to their second hit single. Last time around, boy band Big Fun had achieved chart glory with a remake, but this time, the Some Singing All Dancing Trio tackled an original Saw composition and were back in the UK top 10. This is Can't Shake the Feeling by Big Fun. That was Can't Shake the Feeling from November 1989, which peaked at number 8 in the UK, proving Mark, Phil and Jason were no one-hit wonders. It was also another top 10 hit in Spain and Ireland, and cracked the top 50 in a few other European countries. In Australia, it just sneaked into the top 100, peaking at number 97. For me, this was a huge improvement. For starters, this was a great original song given to the guys by Mike and Matt, which could stand on its own and not be compared to some other version, as was the case with their Blame It on the Boogie remake. There's a hint of drama in this track, and by incorporating some acid house sounds, this felt fresher than their previous release. Matt?
Right, well, not being a Big Fun fan, this record wasn't for me. But after my friend Tony hassled me about it, I can't deny that the composition itself is brilliant. That soaring, ecstatic chorus is sore at their best, but sadly is just a bit wasted here. Imagine what a Donna Summer or a Lonnie Gordon could have done with this song. Give it to a great diva with a powerful set of pipes, sprinkle on some more late 89 house magic, and I think it would have been regarded as one of Soar's finest ever dance moments. Someone should really cover it.
Yeah, I hear you on the vocals, and we're not going to dwell on that. I'd love to have heard Nathan Moore or Paul Varney or someone like that sing this song, but I really do like it. I was actually sent the cassette single by my English pen friend, hi Ashley from County Durham. Honestly, she was a lifeline in the late 80s and early 90s. Not only did I convince her to send me music, although she did draw the line at the expense of a ton of hit CD, but she also sent me stuff from UK mags like Smash Hits and Record Mirror. When I received Can't Shake the Feeling in one of her parcels, I was a bit nonplussed since I hadn't been a fan of Blame It on the Boogie, but when I played it, I was pleasantly surprised at what a step up it was. It was a great Soar track with that big, instantly memorable chorus that you mentioned, Matt, and the production was really good. It felt like Mike and Matt had worked out how to deal with the band's capabilities, and by the band's, I mean Mark's. Let's check in with Matt Aitken about how this track came together.
I have to say, Can't Shake the Feeling. We were really struggling with that, and the original track we recorded for it was nothing like it ended up. And sometimes you get really frustrated with the track, and you're on a keyboard and you stop, you just vamp something out. And I just came up with this keyboard part on a sort of acid house piano. Was it acid house going at that time? A certain piano sound. I probably went, great, get it down. And we suddenly had a groove and a riff, and suddenly the song started to work.
Right, interesting. Now let's listen to the remix, which gives the house influences of this track a lot more room to breathe.
Yes, that was a bit of the extended remix of Can't Shake the Feeling, and on the B-side to that 12-inch, fans also got their hands on I Feel the Earth Move. Interestingly, the main B-side to Can't Shake the Feeling was not a Soar instrumental. In fact, it had nothing to do with Soar or even Harding and Kurnow. It was an original track called Don't Say It's Over, which was co-written by the guys and produced by James Young and Liz Winstanley. In fact, the only connection to PWL was that Dave Ford mixed this as well as Can't Shake the Feeling. Let's have a listen to that B-side. Okay, so that was Don't Say It's Over. What do you think of that, Matt? Very reminiscent of 1987-era, Spunya-inspired Soar, like Love in the First Degree.
Yeah, very 87, and I'll leave it at that. Well, it's good that they got some of their own compositions out there, although according to Phil Kresick, the band didn't really earn anything at all from their B-sides. There'll be a lot more on the financial nightmare of being in Big Fun in a future episode. A more pressing pain at this time for the boys was having to pretend to be straight, because that was one of the most glaring consequences of being in a pop group targeting a mostly young female audience in 1989. And that all came to a head on the Hitman Roadshow. Phil told Hate magazine, "It was very hard throughout Big Fun. Mark and I were together for about 4 years, and it's very hard when you're on the straight tours, in separate bedrooms, and you're meant to be in the closet, when it's so fucking obvious that we were queer. And you were told in press interviews to say you were straight because you have a straight following. We had girls camping outside our door. It was awful having to pretend to be something you're not. You go along with it, it's a money-making machine." Phil went further in an interview published in James Arena's book, Europe Stars of 80s Dance Pop, saying they would not allow us to be out in any way. It was very difficult to have a relationship, and we did end up finally breaking up. I always thought, how could they not know we're gay? I mean, look at our hair back then. On a far less humorous note, Phil revealed just how grim life could be as a pop product because, according to him, his record label even demanded a blood test. Quote, I knew I was HIV positive at the time I signed to the label, but they didn't know it and neither did my manager. Eventually, I had to tell the manager because the label had asked us to all go in for a blood test, thanks to the panic that was surrounding HIV and AIDS at the time. I panicked, but my manager told me not to worry about it and that he would deal with it. He told the label I wasn't going to do any blood test and they finally backed down. It was quite frightening for me at the time because I was afraid this whole thing we had going would fall apart because of my status, unquote. That's absolutely horrific, isn't it, Gavin? It really shines a light on the darkest side of the pop industry, how dehumanizing it can be. You are literally a product and not a person. But I guess it also shows just how far we've come in the decades since.
It can't have been easy dealing with all of that and having to stay silent. People might think he always had a choice, but did he really? Sadly, hiding or even disguising sexuality was par for the course in the late 80s, and as we discussed in the last episode, the ploy worked, because there were those of us who didn't even contemplate that the Big Fun guys might be gay. I have to say, though, that as a 14-year-old who was working out certain things, having a member of a successful boy band come out would have been a big deal.
Right. Well, around this time in 89, it wasn't only dance music that was changing rapidly. So was the teen market. New Kids on the Block were sitting at number one with You Got It, The Right Stuff. The week, Big Fun peaked at number eight. Yes, the post-Bros heirs apparent were here, and despite Pete Waterman's expectations, they were not Big Fun. The teen market was enthusiastically moving on to the newer sound of US-flavoured R&B pop, and they also loved the New Kids' faux street tough image, which was quite the contrast to what PWL was serving up at this time. Big Fun were not igniting in the same way, with their low top 10 peak a notable drop from Saw's usual residency at the higher end of the top five.
To be fair though, Can't Shake the Feeling peaked at the exact same position in the UK as I'd Rather Jack had much earlier in the year. You know, number eight's not too bad.
Well, Gavin, some might say that that was exactly the point where the trouble started. Yeah. But getting back to the rise of the New Kids, to make matters even worse, Pete Waterman had recently slagged the band off in the teen press, predicting they wouldn't fly in the UK. Quote, I can't believe New Kids on the Block are being sold as the new sound of the street. Listen, if those boys are street cred, then I'll show my backside in Burton's shop window. They make the Bay City Rollers look like the Beatles, and yet they've had massive hits in America, and CBS are desperately trying to break them in Britain too. It just goes to show that in America, you can package anything and get away with it. And I hope to goodness they don't take off here, because if they do, then it'll mean suddenly we'll have the record companies putting together package groups all over the place. But I've got a fair bit more faith in the British public. You can wave your hands in the air and wear a silly hat, but in the end, you need something else.
And we all know how much Saw hated people wearing silly hats, don't we? Not nice hats like on the covers of singles and albums, but silly hats. First it was DJs and now it's boy band members.
Well, how wrong could Pete Waterman be? Was he losing touch with the direction of the teen market at this point? It certainly felt that way when New Kids fans deluged Number One magazine with scathing letters over the following weeks, ripping him and his artists apart. Things were certainly changing.
You know, I'll have to side with the fans on this one. I can't say I loved New Kids in 1989. I kind of liked You Got It, The Right Stuff, but I did not like Hangin' Tough or the screechy I'll Be Loving You Forever. But I could see that there was talent there, especially from the lead singers like Jordan and Donnie. And their incorporation of R&B into their sound did place them on the cooler end of the pop spectrum. Compared to Big Fun, they were much more street. Maurice Starr, who'd taken New Edition to worldwide success a few years earlier, really knew what he was doing here.
Yeah, and history shows that New Kids would be the template for teen pop through the 90s and well beyond that. it's even around still now. And as for the package groups, Pete would come around eventually with Steps. The teen audience had been Saw's heartland through 88 and 89, but if they were really moving on, that would be disastrous.
Dun, dun, dun. Okay, that's it for Big Fun for now, but they'll be back when we get into our 1990 episodes. But it's deja vu time again, because we're going to segue from Big Fun to our next act, just like we did a couple of episodes ago.
Yes, Donna Summer is back with the fourth UK single from Another Place and Time, and what an unexpected choice it was. Let's have a listen. That was When Love Takes Over You by Donna Summer, which charted in November of 89, reaching a very disappointing number 72 on the UK chart. Now, was that down to getting lost in the pre-Christmas rush, or was it just the wrong choice of single, Gavin?
Well, if I was looking at Another Place and Time and trying to squeeze a fourth single out of it, When Love Takes Over You would not have been very high on my list. There's not a bad track on the album, but nothing about When Love Takes Over You screams single to me. And not even the Dave Ford single remix changed that. That was the least drastic single remix so far from the album, and it really just lightly freshened up the song for radio and shaved half a minute off the running time. I understand the concept of shifting gears after three big pop anthems, but I probably would have gone for Breakaway at this point instead if that was the case, or even gone really different and chosen Ballad in Another Place and Time. That might have been nice for Christmas. Put some sleigh bells on it. When Love Takes Over You just kind of cruises along in the middle. Nice song, not a hit, and the chart position really bore that out.
Yeah, as good as it is as an album track, and as good as Donna is on it, it's not an obvious hit single, unlike a bunch of other tracks that stayed fixed on that LP. If they wanted a change of gear, I would have rather they brought forward Breakaway just like you, Gavin, or in a perfect world, used Whatever Your Heart Desires if that hadn't already been wasted as a B-side. But I know this single has its fans. I have it on very good authority that Pete Waterman is one who absolutely loves it.
So who was choosing the singles at this point? Well, it certainly wasn't Mike Stock, who's going to weigh in now with his thoughts on the choice of singles from Another Place and Time. Do you think the right subsequent singles, When Love Takes Over You and Breakaway, do you think they were the right fourth and fifth singles, or would you have released some different ones?
Yeah, I look, the choice of singles, I think, to be honest, I regret the fact that we didn't. People who were making the choices, which was more or less David Howells and possibly Donna herself, I don't know, but didn't consult what Matt and I would know instinctively, had the guts right for the next track to go out into the public. So we didn't choose the order or the singles beyond, it was kind of my insistence on This Time I Know It's For Real, because I sort of knew that was a cracker as soon as we finished writing it. After that, the album's done, people make choices, we're on to the next album of somebody else. And so we left that up to other people. And actually, you're right, I don't think they were the right choices, to be honest.
It would have been nice to see if it makes you feel good as a single for someone.
Yeah. Eventually, maybe.
Hashtag justice for If It Makes You Feel Good. Yes, it would have been four bangers in a row, but tell me, where is the crime in that?
Yeah, as we heard from Mike in the last episode, this track had originally been written with Bananarama's Wow album in mind, but the girls apparently weren't enthusiastic. Matt Aitken told Classic Pop that it was his idea to resurrect the track, saying, "I think I suggested that we dust it off and write a song for Donna."
Yeah, I really can't hear Bananarama singing this. That said, it was better than some of the other tracks they were being given around this time, but again, I doubt it would have given them a hit. So what did Camp Donna think about the song? Let's go back to her husband and manager, Bruce Sedano, to find out. Were you too happy with those single choices?
Yeah. I remember, especially for When Love Takes Over You, Donna directed the video. And we shot the video on our ranch in Thousand Oaks, California. It's always a fun time for me to view that video for that song, because I see our property and Donna having a good time. And it's a very colorful and interesting video.
And it was a bit more laid back, that song. You'd had, I guess, in today's terms, you'd call them bangers, but you had three bangers straight out of the gate. And then When Love Takes Over, You took it down a bit. So was it nice to kind of shift gears with that one?
Absolutely. You know, the thing is that, you know, there was always a struggle with radio and balance with Donna, because you know how it is. That people always kind of want to put you in your box and leave you in your box. So whenever Donna came with something that wasn't a banger, so to speak, it was always a more difficult sell. Not because of the quality of the song, the record, the vocal, the mix, any of that. It was always about, oh, well, it's Donna Summer. We really want, you know, so there was always that extra push that you would come up against when Donna would put out a more down-tempo song.
Was there anything else that stood out for you from the album? Any personal favorites that weren't lifted as a single?
I don't think so. I mean, I we didn't mention Whatever Your Heart Desires. That's a nice one. Sentimental. It's funny that you mentioned Sentimental and that Donna not really being excited about it. It's not one of my favorites either. And not because I don't think it's a complete song. This is, you know, there are really things that I like about that song, but I just think that there's something missing in that song. But yeah.
It's nice to hear Bruce talk about that music video. It was a pretty simple clip, but Donna got to muck around and show some of her personality in it, so I can see why it would have enduring appeal for Bruce.
Yes, always love to watch a bit of Donna, and we'll be seeing a lot more of her with the documentary Love to Love You, Donna Summer, coming to HBO in May. I can't wait to see that.
Yes, and that's co-directed by her daughter. Very exciting. Actually, when we spoke to Bruce, he was in Germany for the premiere of that documentary. So, a lot to look forward to there. And we should also mention that as well as helping to steer Donna's career, Bruce was always a musician and songwriter in his own right, and still is. And he actually has a new track out now. Let's hear him talk about his duet with Valerie Simpson.
I have, my current single is doing very well. The next single, I do a duet with Valerie Simpson of Ashford and Simpson fame. We just shot the video for that, and it's a really nice song. I'm playing guitar, acoustic guitar. She's playing piano, and it's just the two of us playing and singing. It's really special. So look out for that.
Two bleeding hearts and a wounded love. Too late now. You know we should have seen it coming, but it happened so fast. We spun out of control.
Okay, that's it for this episode, and we have just a few more Saw singles from 1989 coming up, and all of them would be top 10 hits around the especially important holiday period, so it wasn't time to panic just yet.
Yes, there's some good stories ahead, and then a whole new year waiting to dawn not long after that, bringing a lot of change with it. There's so much coming, so many new acts, and I'll throw one word out as a teaser for 1990. Kakko.
Now, until we are back with the next episode in a couple of weeks, you can head to chartbeats.com.au/saw for this episode's bonus material. It's a big one. We are going track by track through Enjoy Yourself. We're going to count down the songs from 10 to 1 as voted by you, our listeners. And I have to say, this has been the biggest response we've ever had to one of these track by tracks. So yes, the order is determined by the listener votes, but the commentary will be all Matt and mine. I'm looking forward to getting stuck into it.
Sounds good. Can't wait to talk about that. And I think we'll talk a little bit more about the cover art as well.
No doubt. So once again, head to chartbeats.com.au/saw and you can subscribe to listen to the bonus material for this episode and all the episodes. And thank you for your continued support in that respect. Until we're back, come and say hi on social media. You can find Matt at Mr. Matt Denby on Twitter.
Correct. And you can find Chartbeats AU on Twitter and Instagram.
Okay, everybody. Thanks for listening. See you soon.
See you later, everyone.